قبل 7 سنوات في مثل هذا اليوم كان سكان هذا الشارع في حارة حريك كما بقية سكان الضاحية الجنوبية لبيروت يتوضؤون بماء الكرامة قبل بدء ورشة إزالة آثار العدوان من المكان قبل أن يتم إطلاق اللقب عليهم أشرف الناس. ولكن قبل 7 سنوات كان مواطنون أوروبيون يقتحمون مقرا لشركة أسلحة ويطهرون محتوياته من آثار تزويد الطائرات الإسرائيلية بالصواريخ قبل أن يتم اعتقالهم ومحاكمتهم. فما الذي حل به؟
Companies fuel war for profit. People will wonder in the future why and how it was that people tolerated this industry, which is responsible for pouring down death on innocent human beings around the world. I hope that when the arms industry is abolished, that people can look back and see among the actions which ended the arms industry will be this little action in this little town which we undertook.
The sense in which Derry people felt themselves connected to the struggle for justice right around the world. Raytheon arrived in Derry in 1999, the year after the Good Friday Agreement was signed, or the announcement of the opening of the Raytheon plant here was made by John Hume and David Trimble, which was the first thing they did after receiving their Nobel Peace Prizes. And at the time, John Hume said that Raytheon would be welcomed with open arms by all the people of Derry.
The Raytheon factory, an arms company, is going to set up in Derry as part of the peace dividend. And of course, many local people, and not just radicals and civil rights activists, sort of could immediately see the irony in an arms factory being established as part of the peace dividend.
Raytheon coming to Derry was a denial and an affront to all the things that Derry stood for, you know, going right back to the start of the civil rights movement.
We live in a city that suffered the results of war for 30 years. People here know what it's like to see their loved ones die because of a war. The idea that we could actually sit here and have as part of our peace dividend to be that we were going to bring murder and massacres to other countries, we just couldn't accept that.
What finally prompted the occupation of Raytheon was the bombing of Cana in southern Lebanon. When we heard that it was a bunker buster bomb which had caused that massacre in Cana, we are immediately aware that that was a Raytheon bomb, because Raytheon is the sole supplier of such weapons to Israel. On the news, we could see the carnage of Cana. We could see the babies being brought from the rubble of this building and dripping bundles. And we knew that this company that made those bombs had a plant 2 miles down the road. The people of Cana were not distant people from us. You know, if we're concerned about oppression in the world, the people of Cana were our neighbours. The children were the children of our neighbours. So we did it out of we occupied Raytheon, if you like, out of a neighbourly duty.
Seeing all the graves laid out, you know, it was an incredibly emotional thing. Sorry. You know, that was only one bomb, that was one family, and that happened, you know, for 34 days. So it was an incredibly humbling thing, but also, you know, I think just deepened all of our commitment, made us feel even more confident that we would go into the trial and talk about it. And, I'm sorry, I'm getting really overwhelmed here. I don't mean to, but I remember that experience in Canada.
The first time I came across the Raytheon protest, as far as I can remember, is I read an article about it, and I remember thinking, oh, protest in Derry, because I know Eamon McCann, I'm fairly certain that he's going to be in the middle of this.
You know, some people in the anti-war movement were very gloomy about our prospects in Belfast. He said a jury in Belfast was likely to have a majority of Protestants, and he would tend to be unionist, and the perception in Derry would be that would be quite a right wing. But far from it. Far from it. I mean, after the first day, looking at the jury in the witness box, we were following it very closely. And after a few days, we were confident if we can make our case convincing, these people in the jury are going to believe us and we're going to be acquitted. So we had a lot of trust in the jury after a few days, and that trust turned out to be justified.
The fact that a group of protesters could make the sort of protest they made in Derry against this pernicious company go to trial, and the jury and the judge go, yeah, all right, off you go. You were technically committing a crime, but it was in order to prevent a far greater crime, the crime of the arms companies. I think that's an enormously optimistic message, I think, that's been sent out.
The possibility of taking out the mainframe computer, which we believe, and it turned out to be true, would disable not just the Derry plant, but might disable other Raytheon plants, and in the event it did. 25 of us assembled at 8 o'clock in the morning of the 9th of August, which by coincidence was the exact anniversary of the bombing of Nagasaki. We went down to the Raytheon plant. We didn't know whether we were going to get in. As it happened, getting into the plant was very easy. I mean, people were coming in to work, to work in another employment which was in the same building, and as the security people opened the door to allow the workers in, we just made a rush for it, and we got in.
Wednesday, the 9th of August, 2006, Oswald Foyle DCU. At the Raytheon building, there's a number of persons inside have taken over the building and are throwing items, computer disks, paper, etc., onto the roadway.
I was prepared for maybe just blocking the outside doors, if that's all we could have done, to have got through the doors and smashed the front door and got in, barricading ourselves. And I was really relieved that we'd done that.
We got all the furniture in, we put it up against the doors.
We definitely had a real feeling, and I know certainly from a few of us, you know, that we were going to do a lot of damage, or as much damage as we could.
Taking the computers apart, throwing them out the window, smashing all the computers, and we attacked the mainframe computer. Physically smashed it and used a fire extinguisher on it until we were certain that it wasn't working anymore and that we had actually cut the plant off from communicating with any other part of the Raytheon complex.
The person known to me as Eamon McCann. He was quite relaxed, he's not in any aggressive mood.
It was actually a remarkably short period of time in which all that happened, sort of happened in the first half hour.
I mean, we were in touch with the media throughout, I mean, with mobile phones, I mean, and actually in the middle of the occupation I did a live interview with the local BBC.
Eamon McCann's now giving a speech to the assembled press people.
On the line is Eamon McCann, who's inside the building, as I understand it, along with members of the Foyle Ethical Investment Campaign. Eamon McCann, good morning to you.
Good morning, Paul.
What's happening? A bit of noise there, just as we came across here. What's happening at the moment there?
Well, there
is a group of us inside the Raytheon plant here at Springtown. There's about, I think, 8 or 9 inside. There's about 20 people outside. And we've taken this action to, we're disrupting as far as we can the operation of the Raytheon company here in Derry. And we're trying to dramatise the fact, if you like, that Raytheon as a company is inextricably linked into the Israeli military machine. It has a role in the horrible violence which we see, or a little bit of which we see on our television screens every night, and I think it's a widespread feeling that people just want to be doing something about it.
This wasn't simply a sudden protest against Raytheon or a general protest against the arms industry. It was a specific attempt to have a practical impact on what was happening in Lebanon.
The next significant thing that really happened that morning was that these hostage negotiators arrived from Belfast, which made me think, my God, this is a really serious thing. This is like something you see in a film.
Which rather took us all aback because we thought, good grief, I mean, why do they need negotiators from Belfast? But then it turned out that they actually thought that we were probably armed, that this was going to be an armed siege.
Part of my job is to just keep the negotiators talking to prevent the police coming in with their cutting equipment.
And meanwhile, outside, we were all really frightened. We'd all been pushed back out of the car park.
I'm coming back again. Do you think I'm leaving my car out there?
And then we saw these huge cars going in with all these guys with balaclavas up and dogs in the back of them. So we just thought, oh my God, what are they going to do to them?
The police smashed through. They used a chainsaw to cut their way into the place. They came in dressed in riot gear with visors and plastic bullet guns, shouting, "Protesters, we call upon you to surrender," and stuff like that. It was ridiculously dramatic. By this time, we're playing cards because we're bored. We're in there for 8 hours. We had done everything we've come to do, so we're playing cards.
I don't know what images they have, but I had a full house.
Playing cards in the. But they came and arrested us all, threw us on the ground, handcuffed us behind our backs, frog marched us, or escorted us, or dragged us from the premises and took us to jail.
Well, the media are part of the problem, you see. We boast about free speech. There's no point in having free speech if no one hears you. And if you can blank out what is being said or distorted, then you may have had the right to say it, but nobody knows about it.
Newspaper editors and even journalists decided not to cover the story because they politically disapproved of what we had done and therefore didn't want to give it any publicity.
I'm not just saying this for ourselves, but I thought there were some really important things that happened in the trial. I mean, getting that Raytheon executive on the stand was absolutely astonishing. You know, you couldn't have made him up for somebody who was so contentious of protest, of what was happening in the Middle East, says he never watches the news, didn't know really about what happened in Israel and Palestine.
We defended ourselves on the basis that we were not criminals, but attempting to stop a greater crime.
Talking directly to the police, they would sort of say, you know, sort of, oh, why have you done this and why are you using violence? And all of us were very keyed up on that thing about, you know, saying, no, this is non-violent direct action, but we are doing this in order to try and save human life.
We went to Lebanon, one of the things that surprised us was that quite a lot of people knew about the occupation of the Raytheon company here. And
to come so close to what had happened and to see firsthand and meet firsthand the people who suffered in that situation was really, really humbling.
In Cana, we talked to members of the two families. It was two extended families accounted for all the casualties.
We spent billions of pounds ensuring that these companies could construct landmines and heat-seeking missiles that could burn the retinas of anybody who got in the way, instantly blinding them in the most unimaginable agony. There were people who sat around and had cleverly devised this at the same time as there were millions of people around the world who, just by virtue of the fate of where they were born, were desperate for the most basic medicines and basic water and basic food that was being stockpiled in another bit of the world.
The day will come fairly soon when people will look at the arms industry the way they look back now at the slave trade, which supplied jobs, which supplied riches and prosperity to Western cities and countries.
I was thinking, oh, only if Harold Shipman had stopped killing grannies just a few months before he was caught. I was the first doctor to stop killing grannies. Whee! Make him the mayor.
See, the way a change occurs in history is like this. To begin with, if you argue for something, votes for women, a good example, you're ignored. If you go on, you're mad. Had a touch of that myself. If you go on, you're dangerous. Then there's a pause, and then you can't find anyone at the top who doesn't claim to have thought of it in the first place. That is how progress is made. And I think the Stop the War Coalition and the Raytheon campaign are examples. Ignored, mad, dangerous, and now everybody recognises you've got to go about the problem.
What we were doing really was sort of making a tiny contribution to what is an increasing movement around the world. In Britain alone, there are five or six locations at the moment where there are people picketing and demonstrating outside. In the United States, there are people opposing and holding demonstrations against Raytheon. And since our action, we're in touch with those people. All of them contacted us. So we're in email contact with people sort of all over the world.
Treat other people as you would like to be treated yourself. And that is the basic golden rule of world morality, and it's on trade union banners. An injury to one is an injury to all. We have a moral responsibility for each other. And when people actually put that into practice, they may well come into conflict with the law.
Free Palestine! Free, free Palestine! Free, free Palestine!
Well, it's fairly obvious why we're protesting here today. We're in the middle of the Israeli onslaught in Gaza. We know that their F-16 fighters are dropping missiles on a minute-by-minute basis. And we're here in the same way as we were in during the Lebanese war in 2006 to say that we don't want a company in our town that's complicit in the war crimes that have been carried out at the moment.
I think there are two flames burning in the human heart. The flame of anger against injustice and the flame of hope we could build a better world. And all the Raytheon did was to fan, those campaigns fanned both flames of hatred against war and hope that you could do something about it. A very important historical event.
I think if none of us regrets, I certainly don't regret any part of it at all, although there were scary moments along the way, sort of in times of apprehension. I mean, I've been involved in politics for more than 40 years, since the early days of the civil rights movement and the troubles in Northern Ireland, and without any doubt, what we did at Raytheon was the best thing I've ever done in my life.
مشاهدينا من جديد وكل نصر وأنتم بخير. في المحور الأول مشاهدينا عرضنا تقريرا خاصا أعده لبرنامجنا فريق ريثل كي لا تبقى تجربته خارج التغطية. أما الآن في المحور الثاني يسرنا أن نستضيف في قلب الضاحية ضيف متميز اشتهر بقلة ظهوره مع كبر تجربته, يعرف عن الكثير بين لبنان, يعرف الكثير عن الصراع بين لبنان وإسرائيل أكثر مما يعرفه الكثير من اللبنانيين. إنه المتحدث السابق الأول باسم قوات اليونفيل في لبنان الدكتور تيمور جوكسل. دكتور, ويلكم من ضاحية. First of all, what is or when was the last time you have had visited ضاحية?
ضاحية?
Yes. No. When was you, the last time you visited ضاحية?
I come and go. I don't make a no. I'm a tourist now. I live in Beirut. I'm a Beirutian.
Uh-huh.
I have no official business. I come like everybody else.
Oh, so
but I have not been here for a few months.
Uh-huh. What the Dahi means to you?
Look, Dahi, first of all, I know the background of Dahi,
uh-huh.
how it was created, how it came up. Of course, it became much more important in our lives after 2006. And we decided to start bombing this place. I was in Beirut.
Mm-hmm.
I had people escaping from Dahi, coming and living in my neighborhood in empty buildings. So Dahi became a very big name, and it became a symbol of resistance of people.
Mm-hmm.
how you cannot break a people by bombing them. That was what was important about that, yeah? And also, for me, as an outsider who loves this country, it also showed me that the Lebanese can unite when there is trouble for them. Mm-hmm. And it showed me how the whole people united for Zaire. It was it really brought the people together. And and as I said, they gave a very heroic example of resistance of people.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't panic. They left their homes. There was no, most of them were destroyed anyway. They lived in the parks. They lived in the cinema, in Hamlet. And these people showed the resilience of people, how important it is that the people don't feel that way. Okay, you must have an organization. Aside, it's about the organization, but the people, the resilience, the determination of the people, that is the most important thing. I think that's the biggest weapon of Lebanon anyway, the strength of the people.
Okay, indeed, I will return to ask you more about Dahye and especially about this this place where we are walking now. But as a beginning, I would like to ask you about the report of Rachel Group we had seen a few minutes ago.
Yes.
Do you think that the action of these nine men was simply heroic or just a useless emotional reaction towards what they had seen in the news about Canada 2006?
I didn't know about this. I didn't know about this. I'm impressed by it, but it will not change anything.
Uh-huh.
Because you are dealing with a huge military-industrial complex. These are the kind of people who run the U.S. military, U.S. industry. Who is it in one small town in Ireland? You make a protest.
In Derry, yes.
In Derry. I don't know. You know, I'm a guy from South Lebanon. I've been seeing Raytheon on the ground for years. What these sides have been fighting. In the U.S. I remember in 1996.
UNIFIL compound in Kana.
In Amera. No.
Ah.
There was a car hit with a... 70 people got killed in it, children and women mostly. Mansouri? Yeah, near
Mansouri.
Mansouri, right. Okay, Mansouri. That place. We found the Raytheon missile there.
Mm-hmm.
And our famous journalist, Robert Fisk, he took it and went to the United States to the company to ask, did you do this thing? And they said, oh, no comment.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you are dealing with a man, a huge industry complex. Now, this, of course, will not change anything. But it's good that it woke up some people, but not many, huh? Some people in Ireland, maybe, also United Kingdom, right? But it's not going to change anything.
Uh-huh.
No, I admire them for what they did. I mean, not the destruction part, I don't agree with that, but I mean, but their protest, that they care. And then they came to Lebanon, and they went to Cana. These are very interesting stories that we didn't know about, you know?
Uh-huh.
And, but it will not change anything. I hate to say this, but it will not change anything.
Okay, returning to Dahye, I still remember very well when we met a year after the war of July 2006, when you said in a documentary interview that the resolution 1701 is a resolution to manage the conflict,
of course,
not to resolve the conflict.
Yes.
We are standing here in a place a few weeks ago happens an incident known as Bir al-Abed explosion.
Yes.
Do you think that, or do you consider that this incident is somehow related to that management, or it's something different totally about what happened in 2006?
I think this is internal message in Lebanon. I don't think this has anything to do with the conflict in the south.
Mm-hmm.
No, I personally think, I mean, I don't have the inside information, but personally I think, seeing also what happened here, of course, I'm very, very upset. I think this was unfortunately, the internal message of Lebanese politics or the regional politics, I don't think there is any connection with the South at all.
Uh-huh. Okay, I will return to ask you more about this this internal message. According to the late European decision putting Hezbollah on, or the armed wing of Hezbollah among the European list of terrorist organizations, from your point of view, why and why now?
Look, there is tremendous U.S. American pressure. There is tremendous Israeli pressure to hurt anything Hezbollah, to weaken Hezbollah is their goals in life, right? So, and they've been pressing the Europeans on this. So the Europeans felt that they had to do something about this, right? So, but what did they do? They put Hezbollah on the list. What did they say? I read it. Oh, Hezbollah bank accounts are frozen. Yeah, every Mohammed, Hussein, Ahmed have their banks in England, yani. Mm. And Hezbollah military keep their money in Germany. Yes, of course. What are we talking about here? That's a show game. That's a show game. Look, and then you tell me, I'm sorry, I've been living here too long. Hezbollah military wing. Hezbollah military wing? Mm. I said, how come I never met these guys? Then there must be also a Hezbollah social wing. A Hezbollah humanitarian wing, Hezbollah economic wing. Excuse me, the Hezbollah that I know, and I know them from day one, is one. Right? So this was a political game. What is it going to change? Okay, it is a political game. It's a political game. It's maybe, of course, it might upset Hezbollah because it's against their political image, let's say. But on the practical side, what is it going to do? What's it going to do? Is my friend Mohammed somebody, never mind the name, who runs the resistance in the south. Yeah, every week he goes to Italy for the beach and now he cannot travel. What are you talking about?
Yes. An Israeli newspaper commented on that decision that Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah and his fighters will not go to Disney this summer, yani, for example.
These are all political issues, yes. Right? Practically, it means nothing to Hezbollah, if you ask me. Practically, it means nothing. But there is a danger. I'm not just laughing at this. God forbid, in the future, something happens in South Lebanon and Israelis or somebody else, mostly Israelis, they say, hey, wait a minute, these guys are officially terrorists. So we will attack the terrorists.
The terrorists. Yes.
Now, are we giving them a green light for this? This is what scares me. The Europeans say, no, we are not giving green light to anybody. I hope not.
Yeah, but what I did mean by asking you this question about the management of the Resolution 1701, yeah. The same pressure was imposed on Europe during the July War 2006. Yeah. Why the European changed their point of view towards Hezbollah now?
Well, it's not a big change, really. Look, are you telling me that Europeans are not in touch with Hezbollah?
Yes. It's on media.
It doesn't matter, but there is also not reporting in the media, of course. But what I'm saying is this. I think, as I said, there was tremendous American pressure, very heavy. Israeli pressure, which is same as American pressure, of course. And Hezbollah, I mean, there were a few incidents. I cannot say if Hezbollah is involved or not. The Bulgarian incident, the incident in Cyprus. These are all were seen as Hezbollah expanding his operations to outside of Lebanon, right? So I think they felt that they had to be doing something. And I think the final touch was the big embarrassment for the Europeans in Syria. I mean, they are very embarrassed in Syria because they cannot do anything for the help of the Syrian people. Nothing, they are just talking about it. And now they feel that the things are changing in Syria for the favor of the regime, and they think Hezbollah is very important role in this, right? Hezbollah, but the thing is, you know how Hezbollah is. Hezbollah doesn't talk too much, or they never talk anyway. Okay, they were involved in the operations in Qusair, right? Qusair was a military operation. It had a tactical and strategical value, not only human side.
Yes.
But then the next day, after that, every day, Hezbollah is now going to attack Damascus and Aleppo. Excuse me, yeah. Why can't from anybody Hezbollah say, excuse me, we were involved in Qusair because it was our strategic needs, our important military needs. We have nothing to do with Aleppo or nothing to do with Damascus. But you see, when they don't say this, and the Europeans are looking for an excuse to blame somebody for not doing anything in Syria, so why not Hezbollah? Because they changed the war in Syria, excuse me.
Okay, returning to this, happened the explosion. It seems that the people here have covered the hole. Well, returning to this issue about the internal message, it seems that no one in Lebanon is able to foresee what's coming up next, this explosion or another. But it's certain that the outsiders hold either the key of the Lebanese political locks or maybe the match which may spark the explosion. Right. From your point of view, which one of the two options is more close to be happened, explosion or putting the key inside the locks?
No, it's I think this is, it's not all that complicated. This is a message to Hezbollah that they are offending. I hate to say this, but it seems to be some people have this idea of a Sunni-Shia conflict in mind, right? And this is their way of saying to that you are offending and insulting the Sunni too much, that we can do it also. Okay, you are strong, but we can do something also. But this is all they can do. They cannot fight us on the ground. This is all. This is not a very... Okay, it's an explosion, but from what I see, it's an explosion that went downwards.
Yes.
I see too many explosions. I'm not an expert, don't believe me.
Yes.
Okay. I have my own Israel.
Yes.
And this looks, I look at the buildings and the damage. So whoever did it did not want to cause too much
damage
or casualties, especially casualties. Mm-hmm. That's important. Damage is not important, casualties, human losses. But just simply wanted to say, we can do it also. If I can do this one,
I can do the other
next
one.
Time I can put it in the middle of the street and kill 50 people. Mm-hmm. This is what the message is. Now, who sends that message? My God, there are so many people who can do this in Lebanon. Lebanon mm-hmm. has changed from my time. There are too many groups, too many people getting money from outside, too many armed, especially because of Tripoli and what's happening around Trablus. There are too many gun-carrying people. Mm-hmm. The problem is, most of them are very small groups with little structure. You don't know who they are. You cannot keep them under control. Therefore, they have no organization or discipline. This is what the problem is. There are too many small groups with money. Uh-huh. And if they cannot, look, I spent a lot of all my life in the South. If they cannot do it, they'll get a contractor to do it. You know, sometimes, you know, we used to have this funny katushkas to Israel.
Yes.
And everybody, I know Hezbollah. I know Hezbollah. That's not the way they fire. First of all, they don't have that katushka anyway. I know. So you wonder who these guys are. Yeah, then you say, there is Muhammad Abdurrahman and Rasulullah. You pay him $500 to katushka. Anyway, you can do it also. If you want, you have $500, tell Muhammad, here, $5. This is what, how do you control this? This is the reality of Lebanon.
So can you foresee what's coming up next, or it's more hard to expect?
No.
To expect?
First of all, I don't agree with it. No, there are a lot of people who think like me. I don't expect a major war inside Lebanon.
Uh-huh.
First of all, if Hezbollah uses his brains, and they do, if they keep their heads cool, if they don't enter the war, who's going to fight with them? So they are key to this thing. And as far as I know, I don't know the inside story, but from what I see, they are not looking for a war in Lebanon. Okay, so who's going to start a war? The important thing is, can they be provoked into a war?
Uh-huh.
Like this, bomb here, another bomb there, something there. So it's an organization, but it's a disciplined organization. I think it will keep its cool.
Uh-huh.
If they can keep their cool, I don't expect troubles in Lebanon. Because look, if you look what's been happening for the last 2 years, especially with the Syrian war, if you see what's happening in the north near Hanel, Arsab, in that area, normally there should be a war there for the last 2 years, but there is no war.
Mm-hmm.
Because people are using their heads. They live there. They had a war in this country. But what happens there in Lebanon, as I said, there should be a war a long time ago, but they're not fighting. Because the leaders, the people who have control over these groups, don't want a war.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I'm not worried about major organizations. I'm worried about a small group of 10 guys, 15 guys, who gets money from a Gulf country or something, and then calls Mohammed in Surah and says, fire two rockets. But that's so easy to do. What scares me is, as I said, I don't worry about major organizations in Lebanon. They are more or less, disciplined. I'm worried about small groups.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who they are and what they are and what they want. This is the scary one.
Okay, yes. I think that the people of Dahi knows, read well the message, and they know that this is just a very tiny incident according to what they faced in 2006. Dr. Goksel, thank you very much. I am very, I feel very respectful and appreciate very much that you came back to the program. أهلا بكم مشاهدينا من جديد في هذا المحور الثالث من هذه الحلقة الخاصة بذكرى عدوان تموز. نبدأها من المكان الذي قصف في حرب تموز ودمر بشكل كامل عنيت به مبنى قناة المنار في حرب حريق. يسرني يا حاج عبد الله أن أستضيفك في هذا المحور لنتحدث عن آثار الدمار، عودة الإعمار وموقف المقاومة، موقف إعلام المقاومة من يحدث على الساحة. السؤال الأول الذي يتبادر إلى الذهن، نحن الآن أمام مبنى قناة المنار قيد الإنشاء، قد يسأل أي شخص أن الضاحية كلها عادت أجمل مما كانت، قناة المنار ما زالت تبني هذا مقرها الرئيسي، لماذا كان، ما هو التأخير؟
طبعا الأسباب جزء الأساسي منها يعني بتندرج بعاملين. عامل الأول هو موضوع التخطيط والتصميم للمبنى، أخذ وقت شوي إضافي لأن نتيجة أنه أول مرة قناة المنار تدخل بمشروع بناء مبنى خاص فيها،
مبنى تلفزيوني.
تلفزيوني، فدائما كان المباني تاخدها مباني إما يعني سكنية أو صناعية أو تجارية وتعيد تأهيلها بما يتناسب مع احتياجاتها. لا، هالمرة في تصميم لقناة تلفزيونية أو لمبنى تلفزيوني. هذا أخذ ما. مسألة الثانية هو موضوع التمويل. أنت بتعرف أنه التعويضات تبع الحرب تموز، رغم أنه الحزب دخل بموضوع وعد وشركة وعد، بالنسبة لقناة المنار صراحة المبلغ اللي متبقي أو اللي بعد يعني نحن منتظرينه حوالي 20 مليون دولار عن تعويضات مستحقة على الدولة ما اندفعت لحد الآن، وهذا طبعا سبب تأخير هلأ ب يعني تنفيذ المشروع بعد ما استكمل كل شيء اسمه له علاقة بالدراسات وبالمقدمات الهندسية.
نحن واقفين هون في كاميرا حاجة عم تصور الأقسام اللي جوا، يعني إلى أي مدى ممكن نقول أنه ما زالت المنار بالجدول الزمني تحتاج إلى يعني بالنسبة إلى الفترة الزمنية المقررة أساسا؟
يعني نحن بنتوقع إذا تهيأ التمويل وتحرك ملف التعويضات بمجلس الإنماء والإعمار ب يعني هاي العلا الإغاثي، مفترض أنه خلال سنة يعني ننقل يعني بناخذ المبنى مكتمل. هيك الشركة اللي مستلمة التنفيذ عم تخبرنا.
جيد، إذا بندخل هلأ شوي أكثر على المعاني الرمزية قناة المنار. قبل قليل كنت أجري لقاء مع تيمور جوكسل الناطق الرسمي السابق باسم اليونيفيل بمكان انفجار بئر العبد، وكان يستغرب الحديث عن جناح عسكري للمقاومة، يقول أنا لا أعرف أن المقاومة لديها جناح عسكري وجناح إعلامي وجناح صحي وجناح تربوي. حزب الله هو حزب الله والمقاومة هي المقاومة.
صح.
إذا كان الأمر كذلك، كيف ينظر إعلام المقاومة إلى القرار الأوروبي وضع ما اسموه الجناح العسكري؟
أنا أقرأ الموقف الأوروبي أو القرار الأوروبي بأنه يعني هذا التصنيف هو من باب إيجاد مخرج لهم، وهو دليل ساطع وقاطع على أنهم كانوا محرجين في اتخاذ هذا القرار. يعني كانوا تحت الضغط الأمريكي الإسرائيلي، ولكن في أعماق قناعاتهم، ما في قناعة، في أعماق يعني نفسيات وعقولهم ما في قناعة بهذا التصنيف. لذلك هن ذهبوا إلى خلينا نسميها حيلة قانونية تخليهم يظل في عندهم علاقة مع حزب الله، ولكن بنفس الوقت يرضوا الجهات اللي عم تضغط عليهم أمريكيا وإسرائيليا بأنه هن قاموا يعني بخطوة باتجاه موضوع التصنيف، فسموا ما يسمى بالجناح العسكري. وقال حزب الله هذه أول مرة نسمع نحن كحزب الله بهذا النوع من التسميات، نحن حركة إيمانية جهادية مقاومة تمتهن العمل السياسي والعمل الإعلامي والاجتماعي والتربوي والثقافي، وهي هي جزء من مجتمع، من نسيج الاجتماعي. شو في بالمجتمع من نشاطات ومن أنشطة ومن تحركات موجودة بحزب الله؟ يعني لا يغيب حزب الله، كان من العمل الرياضي إلى العمل النسائي إلى العمل الترفيهي إلى الأعمال الجهادية والمقاومة، يعني كل هذه المروحة وبما تشمل من في داخلها من أنشطة متنوعة حزب الله موجود فيها. فإذا حزب الله لا يمكن تسميته أنه جناح عسكري أو منظمة عسكرية أو هذا. حزب الله هو جزء من المجتمع اللبناني بكل تلاوينه، بكل مخزونه الثقافي والفكري والجهادي والعسكري والمدني بكل تلاوينه. وحزب الله بعتقد أنه يعني قدم نموذج حضاري متقدم جدا ورفيع جدا، غاض العدو الإسرائيلي، اغتاض منه العدو الإسرائيلي، وعمل في موضوع التصنيف العدو الإسرائيلي ليس من الآن، يعني من الثمانينات، من بداية يمكن المنتصف الثمانينات بدأ العدو الإسرائيلي يشعر بأن حزب الله يشكل خطر حقيقي عليه، وبأن إذا كان هناك من هزيمة يمكن أن يتلقاها العدو الإسرائيلي أو الجيش الإسرائيلي فهي ستكون عبر هذا التنظيم وعبر هذه الحركة الإيمانية الجهادية. طبعا موضوع المنار هون تحديدا، أنا بعتبر أنه ما حدث في المنار هو حدث قبل 2006، يعني كمان التصنيف الأمريكي والتصنيف الأوروبي والمنع الأوروبي للأقمار الصناعية الأوروبية من بث قناة المنار كانت بمثابة الضوء الأخضر للإسرائيليين بأنه قناة المنار هي يعني غير محصنة، أو من ناحية السياسية أو من ناحية الإعلامية. لذلك نحن كنا متوقعين أنه إذا صار في أي حرب سنكون هدف من أهداف العدوان الإسرائيلي، وعملنا ترتيباتنا على هالأساس، واليوم نحن كمان بنشتغل على هالأساس، بنشتغل على قاعدة أنه نحن هدف دائم للعدو الإسرائيلي. طبعا نحن يعني بنفتخر بأنه نكون هدف لمثل هذا العدو، يعني نحن معركتنا مع أشرس ومع أقبح جهة يشهد كل العالم وكل المجتمع الدولي على عدوانيتها، على إرهابها، على اغتصابها للحق الفلسطيني، على اغتصابها للحقوق العربية واللبنانية، على تدنيسها للقدس، على تهويدها للمقدسات المسيحية والإسلامية في فلسطين، على صلافتها، على خروجها عن القوانين الدولية والتشريعات الدولية، على تاريخها الدموي الإرهابي الذي لم يترك جريمة ولم يترك نوع من أنواع الخروج عن الإنسانية وعن القانون إلا ما ارتكبها. نحن نعم هذا عدونا.
العام الأوروبي أعتقد أنه بيعرف هذا الشيء. نحن يعني ببداية الحلقة عرضنا تقرير لمجموعة رايتون، هي مجموعة من الناشطين اللي دخلوا إلى مقر شركة رايتون اللي بتسلح الطائرات الإسرائيلية وأتلفوا أوراقها ومسنداتها. نعم. وأرسلوا المقابلات اللي عم يحكوا فيها. نعم. عن شعور تجاه إسرائيل وتجاه الشعب اللبناني. طيب إذا بدي انتقل لموضوع إعلامي أكثر عمقا، يعني من المعروف اليوم كما يقال، وربما تكون هذه إشارة صحيحة، لأن معظم وسائل الإعلام اليوم أصبحت متاريس إعلامية يستخدمها المتخاصمون من أجل الفرض السيطرة وكسر الآخرين. طيب هل دخلت المنار ضمن هذا التصنيف؟ وإذا كان الجواب نعم، من تعتبر منار نفسها خصما لمن؟
لا، المنار من الأساس هي كانت تقول عن نفسها بأنها هي خارج منطقة الحياد، أو هي لا تؤمن بأن هناك حياد في الإعلام. ونحن نعتبر أن الإعلام رسالة، والرسالة يعني أن تدافع عن قضية، ونحن قضيتنا قضية القدس وفلسطين والمقاومة وتحرير الجنوب اللبناني وتحرير الأرض اللبنانية. هذه الرسالة هي رسالة معلنة منذ أن انطلقت المنار كقناة المقاومة والتحرير، ومنذ أن انطلقت المنار كقناة للعرب والمسلمين. نعم، نحن منذ البداية كنا ننحاز لقضية شعوبنا، قضيتنا المركزية، قضية فلسطين. ونحن بنعتبر أنه ما حدث في 10 سنوات الأخيرة الذي هو كشف أقنعة ليس أكثر من ذلك، هو كشف أقنعة عن وسائل إعلامية كانت تدعي بأنها في منطقة الحياد الإعلامي أو هي موضوعية أو هي متوازنة أو هي تحاول أن تقدم الرأي والرأي الآخر. أنا برأيي كل هذه الشعارات سقطت، والإعلام من الطبيعي جدا أن يكون جزء من المعركة.
يعني هل وسعت المنار دائرة الخصوم؟
نعم، نحن دائرة الخصوم ستبقى هي موجهة باتجاه العدو الإسرائيلي والمحتل الإسرائيلي للأرض اللبنانية ومن يتعاون مع هذا المحتل أو يخدم مشروع هذا المحتل. نحن بوصلتنا واضحة جدا، طريقنا واضح جدا، مقاييسنا معاييرنا واضحة جدا، لم تتغير منذ أن انطلقنا إلى الآن. نحن مقياسنا ومعيارنا هو العداء لإسرائيل وهو المقاومة للمحتل الإسرائيلي. من يدخل إلى هذا المشروع ومن يلبس هذا اللبوس ومن يدخل نفسه ويقحم نفسه في هذا المشروع فهو الذي يضع نفسه في مواجهتنا، في مواجهة المنار أو في مواجهة حزب الله، وليس العكس على الإطلاق. نحن لا نبحث عن أعداء، لا نبحث عن خصومات، لا نبحث عن جبهات إعلامية جديدة نفتحها. نحن جبهتنا بعد هي ذاتها، هي المقاومة التي تقاتل من أجل الأرض اللبنانية وتحريرها ومن أجل مساعدة الشعب الفلسطيني في العودة إلى أرضه.
يعني احنا بختام هذه الحلقة وختام هذا اللقاء ما يعني لا يسعنا إلا ما أقول كل عام وانتم بخير حاج،
وانتم بخير ينعاد عليكم
مصر والمنار وكل العاملين فيها.
نحن اليوم أكثر إصرار وأكثر ثقة بالنفس بأنه ستعود المنار أجمل مما كانت كمبنى، وبعتقد أنه المثل الشعبي اللي بقول الضربة اللي ما بتكسرك أو ما بتكسر لك ظهرك بتقويك. نحن إن شاء الله هذا المثل بينطبق علينا.
شكرا جزيلا،
أهلا فيك. يا هلا، يعطيك العافية، يعطيك العافية.
إذا مشاهدينا إلى هنا ونصل إلى ختام هذه الحلقة. في ختامها ثلاث كلمات لأشرف الناس ومحبيهم: كل نصر وأنتم بخير. وللشرفاء مجموعة ريثون في مدينة دري من بقي حيا في جنوب لبنان والضاحية الجنوبية، شكرا لكم ولا أراكم الله في بلادكم سوءا. أما للحكومات الأوروبية التي لم تنصف المقاومة فدعوة لزيارة الضاحية، اقتربوا من إسفلت شوارعها فقط، عندها ستسمعون همسا لشباب قضوا كي تبقى كرامتهم، وإذا دققتم ستلمحون ماء جرى من عيون آباء وأمهات اشتياقا لشهدائهم، لكنهم في سبيل الكرامة أيضا وليس المصالح. حرصوا على أن تكون هذه الدموع خارج التغطية. مشاهدينا، السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.